It is still Lent, so Liel is still not swearing, but as you will hear on this episode, I have big things to swear about, so if there are delicate ears nearby, cover them. This has been your obscenity warning.
I'm going to identify you as an historian.
Okay.
Does that work for you?
Sure.
Do you prefer a historian or an historian?
No.
Whichever way you want to go.
Hello, J. Crew. This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast. I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined this week by Deputy Editor Stephanie Butnick.
Hello.
And Senior Writer Liel Leibowitz.
Ahalan, wasta halan.
And this week, there are two Jews of the Week. First, we're going to talk to Israeli food writing superstar Gil Havav, author of an amazing new memoir, and then historian Allen Robert Ginsberg, whose recent book is about Jewish women in the early 20th century. Before we go any further, I do want to say, I want to put this at the top so that it's fresh in our listeners' minds on the treadmill Thursday morning, that we have a special Ask Unorthodox episode coming up. Our last advice episode was a big hit. We're going to do special advice for Passover. So write to us sometime in the next week. Write to us with your questions about Passover. It can be about ritual. It can be about why do we do this instead of this. It can be etiquette questions. How do I deal with my father-in-law's political opinions over the charoset? It can be anything. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or answer the call for questions on our Facebook group page or call us and leave a message at 914-570-4869. Listen, please do it now. Time is running out. We're sorry we got a late start on this, but if you could send us your questions basically immediately, by Tuesday the 13th, if you could send us or call us or Facebook post us your questions, they may be incorporated into our special Ask Unorthodox Passover
show. It's the Exodus. You should rush. That's the whole point of the
holiday. Rush. Hurry up. Hey, Stephanie, what's going on in your life?
Something big is going on in my life.
Okay.
A hundred big things.
Tablet Magazine just launched this amazing new feature that I've been lucky enough to work on. It's called 100 Most Jewish Foods. That is a list of the 100 most Jewish foods.
Are they the most tasty Jewish foods?
Probably not.
Are they the most even edible Jewish foods?
Possibly no.
But they're the 100 greatest.
They're basically the foods that have had the most profound impact on Jews and Jewish identity and Jewish culture across both the globe, but also throughout history. So like one of my favorite entries is Jacob's lentil stew, like the actual lentil stew in the Bible that Esau sold his birthright for. Like how good must that have been?
Yeah. The recipe was a little bit... they did use
it was worth it.
They did use an Instant Pot, though. It is recorded in the Bible.
Instagram.
Yeah.
What I want to say, having had nothing to do with the production of this amazing new tablet feature, is the contributors you got were like, it's like food writer Leah Koenig, and it's Jill Kargman from Odd Mom Out, and it's Marjorie Ingle, and it's
Eric Repair.
Yeah, I mean,
Amanda Hesser. It's like such good writers.
And the better thing is actually the pairing of writers and foods, right? So Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs of Food 52 wrote about brisket, and their angle is basically they are wasps who grew up on like pot roast and they just love brisket. And so
Michael Solomonov, greatest chef,
he wrote about Kugel. And, you know, sort of people writing about things you wouldn't necessarily expect. We have Eric Repair, the great chef, writing about gefilte fish and actually comparing it to like a pike quenelle. That it actually is like this delightful thing. You know, we have, of course, Joe Nathan writing about chicken soup.
But except for me, I write about things exactly you would expect.
Yeah, Liel took precisely. I mean, Liel has like 12 entries, obviously, and they're like, all so good.
But, I was racially profiled.
It's like,
you do the hummus and the shakshuka.
And we worked with Gabriella Gershenson, who's this amazing food writer and editor. And the entries are just so good. We have today's guest, Gil Havav, writing on soup mandel and kuba. And I mean, the range of food is just unbelievable. I mean, there's like pcha, which is jellied calves.
Ooh, I knew about that.
Which is amazing.
Every time I learn about that, I block it out again, that
Sorry.
It exists.
It's great.
And we have Michael Twitty writing about it. I mean, it's just...
You have Dr. Ruth writing about
the
pomegranate.
We have our former guest, Phil Rosenthal. He wrote about Entenmann's donuts and how he came home every day after school and would eat them and just watch TV. And just the way food functions in the Jewish consciousness is something we can't avoid. So we've done basically best Jewish books, movies, songs. This is definitely going to be our most controversial list.
So if you're a fan of Jews, food, Stephanie Butnick, or all three things, you should check out this amazing, amazing entry.
What's the website? The URL?
100jewishfoods.tabletmag.com.
100jewishfoods.tabletmag.
We're sharing it with the hashtag 100jewishfoods. We'll be on Instagram. The best part of it, this is actually the feature is one table with all 100 foods on it, which is not photoshopped.
We
sourced and cooked all the food and put it all with these amazing food stylists and prop stylists. And you actually can spin around the table and see the food and click on it. And it's just this interactive, amazing
feature. It's a virtual reality experience, basically.
Yeah, it's like an e-smorgasbord.
E-borg.
All right. I have big news from the Oppenheimer front.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And I'm going to give you guys a multiple choice question, and you're going to tell me which you think.
I was not prepared for a pop quiz.
Yes, you were not prepared for a pop quiz. And I would like the listeners at home to take this too. You may want to hit the pause button at some point and discuss with your family or the people driving in the car.
Talk amongst yourself.
Talk to yourself.
Phone a friend.
Which of these four things is true? You ready? Number one, that Sid and I are expecting a baby boy. One of these four things is true.
Oh, my Lord.
Number one.
Wow, coming out strong.
Yeah.
That Sid and I are expecting a baby boy. Number two, that because I was never circumcised, something I've never written about or talked about, I've decided it really is time to have a bris.
On the air.
And well, not on the air, but we're going to do a documentary about it. There will be some recording going on, and certain colleagues may be invited if they can stomach it. Okay. Number three, we're getting two more dogs. Sid was on a late night puppy porn pet finder spree, and without asking me, she put in adoption papers for two puppies who are being fostered right now in Galveston, Texas. Not dogs we need, but we're getting them. Or number four, I have decided, because lots of people have written and said, you know, we love you, Mark, why don't you have a congregation, that I need to get smicha, that I need to get ordained, and I've enrolled in Hebrew College's program. I'm going to do it part-time. They worked out something very nice there, because Sharon Annisfeld, the president of Hebrew College, actually did my wedding, and she's worked out something where over 7 years, I will go on a slower program, I will get ordained.
I'm going three.
Which of those four things is true?
Absolutely three. I have no doubt for 1 second.
The puppies.
Congratulations for new dogs.
Okay.
I want a process of elimination. Are you swearing to us that only one is true? It's not going to be like, by the way, it's all four.
Yeah.
No. I swear to you that only one is true.
My uncircumcised penis. No, I'm not making penis jokes.
I want to say number two, there's no way you've never brought that up before.
Absolutely.
It would surprise me knowing your willingness to talk openly about yourself.
Mark would talk about his penis,
and
there's no doubt there.
But the conversations we've had about that on the show.
Right.
I just would have been surprised to have not. I would be surprised if, were that to be true, I would have not picked up on any of that.
Right.
Sitting here for 3 years with you. I mean, talking about that stuff, whatever. I want one to be true really badly. I would like a little Boppenheimer. It's a boy Oppenheimer.
I do too. But
very specific. The rabbi thing is also specific. So I'm between three and four.
No, I'm going with three.
I'm going with four.
You have to pick. You're going with four. Shira Talushkin and Josh Cross in the studio, in the editor's booth. What do you think? You're recusing yourselves. Okay. Recusal by Josh Cross.
These are
Shira
really
Talushkin.
Big things.
I'm dropping bombs. I'm nervous.
Now, here's the thing. We're going to do it. Now, listeners, take honest stock of your beliefs at this point, in case we decide to do like a poll on the Facebook page of what you really thought before I did the reveal. Okay? Okay. We're having a baby boy.
Holy cow.
My Lord.
I felt that insofar as the Butnick Cohen wedding, the engagement was announced on air.
It was.
By Stephanie, who had not told us previously. I owed it to the J. Crew and all of you to tell you.
Wait, so you're not becoming a rabbi?
I am not, insofar as I know, in the next 7 years. You know what I'm definitely not doing? Is taking on another job.
This is crazy.
This is amazing.
So we are having a baby boy. The due date is, I'll just say, early September.
That'll be nice.
Yeah, and
fantastic.
This is good. We're keeping the September events scheduled.
Totally.
Is good. Maybe
so next year.
Maybe
Lily
can do a big party next year.
I should do something. Yeah.
Molly Ye will be catering the bris. I don't know. I don't know if she will, but you know.
No, she will now.
It makes sense that one went to two because one would be a baby boy, and then two would be the circumcision. So I see then how you made that jump to make that up.
So that's amazing.
That's all the news I got for you on that now.
And of course,
have you told the girls?
We have.
What do they say? What do each of them say?
I will only
say, and Ellie's like,
because I want to protect their privacy, I will only say that among their concerns was that it was a boy. I will just say that.
My God, that would be the most pampered kid in history.
That was among their concerns. What did we think we were doing getting a boy? Why?
Isn't this literally all of a kind family?
No, I think all of a kind family is five girls, and then they have the boy.
And then
they have the boy. I don't know of a literary antecedent to four girls and a boy. Five girls would have been Sense and Sensibility, right? Or Pride and Prejudice. Four girls as Little Women. I don't know what Four Girls and a Boy is.
See, I know the Blooms are three girls and then a younger boy. And
who's that?
My friends, the Blooms.
Oh, your friends, the Blooms. Yeah.
And that, I mean, it's amazing. But he has like four moms. It's incredible.
All the love in the world. Now, so of course, the child will be named by our listeners. in this year's donation drive.
What do we set the level at for giving in our summer fun drive?
$15,000
to name my son.
You can name
the
Shelton
amazing.
And Miriam Adelson Oppenheimer boy.
A Boppenheimer.
Sally Goldstein Zilberstein Oppenheimer.
I'm glad we made those onesies.
Yeah, right. Okay, so some less important news of the Jews. First of all, the Netanyahu dog died, Kaya. We're a little behind on this, but a couple weeks ago, Kaya, age 12.
We're dog years behind.
We're dog years behind. Apparently the dog...
Yehi zichra baruch.
Apparently, apparently the dog collapsed 2 months ago, had some surgeries, there's a herniated disc, then she was paralyzed. I don't know if they put her down or if they just let nature take its course. But while that dog died, two new dogs were born. Apparently Barbara Streisand, according to an interview in Variety magazine, Barbara Streisand revealed that before her Coton du Tulliard died,
Sammy of blessed
her dog, her gourmet dog, in 2017, some cells were extracted, and later that those cells were used to generate two clones, Miss Violet and Miss Scarlet. She initially dressed both dogs in red and lavender to tell them apart. First of all, I think this is fake news. I don't think you can actually clone dogs.
She wrote about it in the New York Times.
Yeah, okay. I still think it's fake news. Second, all of my hostility toward Barbara Streisand has just been justified. QED.
I'm so with you there. You have
I always
no
said
idea.
She was insane ever since I read about her doll museum in her basement in People magazine, her fake marriage to James Brolin, who's, by the way, brilliant on that sitcom Life in Pieces. But anyway, I just think like she's so overrated. Like she was a great singer 40 years ago.
She was a singer 40 years ago.
She was a singer 40 years ago.
That's about it.
You guys done? You got it all out?
Yeah.
Stephanie's
yep.
like, calm down.
Babs,
simmer down now.
Babs can do literally whatever she wants. She can do whatever she wants. She can have a museum in her basement. She can have all these dogs. I do not care. And I think there's something...
Because funny girl? Because 50 years ago, funny
because
girl?
Because I think she's an iconic Jewish woman. And I think that I want to say, and I'm not accusing you guys of anything, I think it's easy to mock Barbara Streisand because she has become so
Stephanie,
larger than
she's
life.
She's cloning dogs. It's like Kim Jong-un territory. Like she's like insane.
So you know what? Let's talk about a Jewish woman we can agree is great. Ali
yes.
Raisman.
Yes.
Yes.
Just on fire. She's suing the U.S. Olympic Committee and USA Gymnastics because she feels they didn't do enough to stop Team Dr. Larry Nassar from sexually abusing the athletes, including her. So she filed her lawsuit last Wednesday in California.
God bless.
We just want to say, like, Ali Raisman for president. That's basically what we're saying. You know what Ali Raisman also doesn't do is endorse Louis Farrakhan. You know who does? It's so it seems a couple leaders of the Women's March, including Tamika Mallory, who was recently seen applauding Farrakhan at a big speech. She seems not to care that Farrakhan has said, among other things, that trans folks were invented by greedy Hollywood Jews to destroy the black community. She seems not to care about his history.
It was Barbara Streisand.
She seems not to care about his history of saying that Hitler was a great man. Instead, she sends out tweets saying, if your leader does not have the same enemies of Jesus, they may not be the leader. In like basically identifying herself, like I'm being oppressed the way our Lord on the cross was oppressed.
By those murderous
heaps. I am not a slave. She tweets out, I'm a strong black woman who will not live in fear of any man or woman. I mean, all of this stuff. And like, I take very seriously the oppression and silencing of any voice. And I absolutely think she has a right to talk. She seems not to know or care that Farrakhan is not only an anti-Semite. And here's what's so interesting, right? A certain portion of the left has made their peace stupidly, wrongly, with anti-Semitism in their leaders. But Farrakhan is a world-class misogynist, like a world-class woman hater. And she seems either not to know or not to care.
Also, you would think the homophobic stuff right. would be actually like, I mean, like, I get it. Like, we're past the point. Like, I'm kind of on board now with like, people don't really care that people are
Israelic. We could do all that or we could blame the Jews.
Right.
I have to say, Rabbi Sharon Bruce of Ikar in Los Angeles had a really interesting Facebook post. And she just sort of about this. And she sort of says, like, she's active in, you know, the women's movement. She's one of the Jewish figures sort of at the forefront of that. And mm-hmm. she said, you know, there's no room in a multi-faith, multi-ethnic coalitional movement for anti-Semitism, homophobia, or transphobia, full stop. And then she sort of goes on to say that the community, there's clearly a misunderstanding going on here. We sort of all not. I'm not saying that we have a Louis Farrakhan, like, but I think there's a way in which a lot of our elder statesmen in different capacities, like, are sort of a different generation, and so it's sort of hard to say he did a lot of good, but also has these awful, like,
I don't think Farrakhan did any good though.
No good
is the problem.
I understand,
and I'm very fond of, and I respect Sharon, and I respect her teaching. I just don't, you know, there are people who are complicated figures because on the one hand, they're the extraordinary tribunes of the people. On the other hand, they have a dark side. Most of us have a shadow.
I mean, her argument is that, like, she basically says that elder statesmen of different communities actually are themselves, in a lot of ways, prejudiced against other communities. And so people who advocate so strongly, I'm not defending him, but I'm just sort of saying that she pointed out there's a generational thing in that those who advocate so strongly for, especially a minority community, also kind of might.
But to call him an elder statesman of any community, I think, is a deep miscarriage of justice.
I mean, I just think this is part of how this new progressive left, right, this new feminist movement is going to have to figure this out, right? Like,
Yeah, and it has to do better. I mean, here's the thing. Is like a progressive Jewish coalition has to say Naftali Bennett is an anti-Arab racist, right? And we do. And, you know, similarly, there have to be people in the movement who say we can do better than Farrakhan. I mean, ultimately, it's about honesty, right? You can say, look, Farrakhan is a doddering old man. There's no percentage in spending lots of time tearing him down. But then if someone says to you, how do you feel about his transphobia and anti-Semitism? You have to say, yeah, that's horrible. That's all it takes, is really just a candor about who he is.
And in the words of a great rabbi, Rabino Shimon Bar Malcolm X, we're nice to people who are nice to us, and we're mean to people who are mean to us.
Our Jewish guest this week, he's a star. We're so happy to have Gil Hovav here. He's a food personality in Israel. He's a food writer. You're on TV. You're everywhere.
And can I say, I was a fan long before you guys were fans.
We were pre-trend on Gil Hovav. And he has a new amazing book. It's called Candies from Heaven. It is just the sweetest thing I've ever read. And Gil, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Gil.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, of course.
Before we talk to you, Liel, now that he's popular with, you know, the masses, have you decided he's peaked and he's past his prime and you're done?
Yeah, I'm going to look for another Israeli chef.
You're done with him?
Yeah.
Anyway, Stephanie and I still love you. So thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much. Yes.
So today at Tablet Magazine, we're celebrating the launch of 100 Jewish Foods, 100 Jewish Foods. foods.tabletmag.com, and it's a list of the definitive most Jewish foods, not the best, not the most loved, but the most essentially Jewish.
Not even the most edible in
definitely
some cases.
Definitely not.
Yes, there's gefilte in it, so there.
Yeah. So Gil, we were lucky enough to have you contribute two of the entries. You did kubeh, and you also did soup mandel.
Yeah.
And I think we need to start with soup mandel for this interview.
Soup mandel is just what we live on. I mean, my daughter, when I serve soup, it immediately becomes this mush of yellowish stuff. She just pours more and more and more soup mandel into the bowl. In Hebrew, it's called shkedei marak.
Yeah, even the English name is so lame. Shkedei marak is soup almonds. It's so beautiful.
Yes, the English name sounds a bit Yiddish.
Yeah, it does.
And then shkedei marak is Israeli. Yeah, it's rough.
So can you, for those of us who didn't grow up eating that.
And it's really rough. You know, it sounds like there's a soup almond tree that you chop down into little bits of soup
almond. And your parents go and tell you soup almonds don't grow on trees.
So for those of us, I know people in America have grown up with them, but I didn't, and I'm assuming Mark did not either.
I grew up with Domino's pizza and Friendlies.
Well, stop bragging.
My condolences.
No. It was a happy childhood. Sorry, in many ways.
Will you explain what they are?
It's a sort of a crunchy thing, yellowish. It looks like nuclear waste. And we love it. We love it. We love it. It's meant to add something to chew on when you eat soup, but it's also consumed as a cracker or whatever.
It is basically the color yellow, only edible.
Yes.
It's the best description of that.
It's E something. E, yeah. And a lot of digits after the E.
But we love it. And your entry really does get to the point that this is perhaps, you know, one of very few verifiably indigenous Israeli foodstuffs. We invented this.
Yeah. And we're very proud of it.
We're very
proud of it.
So speaking of food in Israel, when you started out, which is when I kind of started paying attention.
When you were really getting into your eating,
really
Liel.
When I was getting heavy.
Yeah. God, he's so skinny.
The scene was sort of like, you know, there were a few good restaurants. There were some hummus places, some falafel places. But it was kind of, you know, just a normal Hamishit country. Now, it is, thanks a lot to you in great part, it's completely food obsessed. It has undergone this great revolution. What happened?
First of all, I think we got rich. So the food revolution occurred in the 80s. You had Reagan and we had our own Reagan. You should remember that Israel was established as a socialist country. So back in the 50s and 60s, it was almost impolite to enjoy food. And and there weren't many opportunities, too.
It was like decadent and bourgeois to have like a really good meal with a good wine.
Totally. I grew up in a fairly well-to-do home. So we dined out a lot because both my parents were career people. It was so uncommon. People went to restaurants maybe once a year for a birthday, and what we call a restaurant is not necessarily what they went to. And so people looked at us as if we were really like...
Like you'd pull up in a limousine or something and your chauffeur had...
Exactly, or at least on a white horse. They just thought that it was so bizarre because everybody ate at home and that's it. And actually, people ate good food at home, but The few good restaurants that we had in Jerusalem in those days, when I look back, they were so naive. Like I remember in the restaurant of Jerusalem, Mishkenot, and in the second restaurant of Jerusalem, Chez Simon, the dessert was a crepe Suzette, but it wasn't a French crepe Suzette. It was like this blintzes with like a fruit salad from a can, for God's sake. Dreadful.
Chez Simon.
It's in Jerusalem. Yeah.
So is there any backlash? Like, has it gone too far?
I think that food TV got too far all over the world, and this is why I shied away from doing food television. I think people are really too obsessed. I do not think that chefs should be rock stars. I do not want to hear the theory of cooking by chefs and songs about eggplants by chefs, etc. So this,
but you're not talking about anyone in particular.
No. And he didn't open a restaurant in New York recently.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that this is kind of too much. But other than that, why shouldn't we enjoy food?
Wait a second. But you have been a TV personality. You've created several TV shows. Yes.
Yes,
so,
yes.
I mean, you were saying just a second ago, unless I misheard, that chefs should not be TV personalities.
No, and I think that the way when I was doing TV food on television, it was very modest. Nowadays, all these reality shows, I really loathe them. And they always want me to come and be a judge or whatever. And I say, no, I don't do that. So I do other stuff on television.
I will say that my kids, one of the great shows, and how old's Naomi? Your daughter?
14 and a half.
Okay, so she's past this age, but when you have a 5 or 6 year old, MasterChef is about the best TV you can show them because, they bleep out Gordon's swearing. I mean, it's relatively profanity free, and the excitement is not murdering people, but just chopping stuff. And I mean, it's good
the
TV.
The terror is there.
Yeah,
still.
The terror is there.
So at least in Israel, the Israeli version of MasterChef, first of all, you must be a prostitute or a rabbi, which is sort of the same. And you must be cooking in memory of your dead brother who died because he was a drug addict, and then it's tears, and then they tell you that you don't cook good enough and they throw you out. I don't think that I want Naomi to be educated on this kind of television.
And so coming from Israel, where you go to what we call the Irkan, which is a term that doesn't exist here, the greengrocer, I suppose, and you buy real actual fruit and vegetables that taste like real actual fruit and vegetables, and then you come here to America. Even here in New York City, what do you find? What's food like here for you?
It's a Luna Park. It's fun. It's not necessarily always fresh in the sense that freshness is treated in Israel. So it may be vegetables that grew in, Spain and then spent 2 months in a fridge and then came to New York. And it's quite perplexing. But for me, the thing that bothers me the most is that the cooks cook here with gloves on. I hate it. And whenever I come to give lectures in America and to do food demos, they always want me to put gloves on, and I refuse. No gloves, no condoms. We're cooking now. Let's touch our food. And this is something that you Americans brought to the world, and you are to blame for it. There is this gel that you keep using to clean
Purell,
your hand.
Purell.
Oh God, brother, why are you doing that? And then they serve me these wet towels by the end of
that.
I hate it.
Me too.
But just to show you how different Israel is are than Americans. Once, I'm a restaurant critic in Israel for 30 years now. Once I was sitting in a restaurant with my partner, and immediately when dinner was done, the waiter rushes to us with these wet towels. My partner takes them immediately because he loves it, just like you. And I look at the waiter and I say, why are you giving this to me? I don't need it. I've been using cutlery. My hands are clean. He looks at me and he says, do you really want to know where our cutlery was before you used it?
Oh. I said, okay, okay.
But you know, you touched on something so interesting, because one of the biggest arguments that my wife and I have is about, you know, recurring arguments is about precisely this. She's like, did you wash your hands after you touched it? Like, no, no. Because I don't need to.
I'm totally with you, and I'm raising my children Israeli style, which is to say they bathe, but then
dirty.
They don't. But they don't have to like wash your hands 20 times a day.
Yes, yes. Yeah, you know, Lisa for some reason believes that you can't touch raw meat and then touch other things. That's just crazy
to
me.
And then caress your husband's face.
Right.
That's right. Anyway, we apologize.
I hand sanitize like 6 times during this conversation. I have a spray. It smells so good. Everyone in the office, I have like a pump next to my desk. Everyone can smell it because it's like a good smelling one.
The fact that you also host podcasts while wearing gloves says
that's
a lot
true.
About you.
But is that a distinctly Israeli thing? Because I feel like there is this perception that Israelis are like tough and of
earthy.
The land and not afraid to get their hands dirty. And then Americans are like literally wearing latex gloves to touch anything. And like me spraying my hands. Is it a stereotype or is it
no,
real?
No. And I think that you are the weird ones. I mean, you're the majority,
I'm definitely
of course,
weird.
But you are the weird ones. I mean, the world as we know it does not use this gel or liquid or whatever. In America, it's just like oxygen. So
what's great about America?
Ah, lots of stuff. First of all, I lived in America for 3.5 years and I've learned a lot and I learned to admire America and I love America. I hate American film. You were talking about the Oscar before.
Yep.
I have a rule. I never watch a film that was made by a person carrying an American passport. Never, ever, ever in my life.
That's a little extreme.
No,
that's
I'll tell you why it came to be. I was living in San Francisco for 3.5 years and I was the correspondent for Haaretz, a newspaper in Israel on the West Coast. You know, nothing goes on the West Coast except for Hollywood. So I would travel to Hollywood to interview those idiots, idiots, women with boobs the size of a Zeppelin and men with teeth. It looked like they swallowed a piano. Dreadful, dreadful. And they were talking with these serious faces about their art. And what were they talking about? A film about dinosaurs? Come on, this is no art. This is trash. So I decided that never again will I watch a film made by an American
Not
person.
Not a single American film material.
So they persuaded me only once. They said, there's a film that was made about you. It's about you. You must watch it. It's about this rat that cooks. What's it
called? Ratatouille.
I went in. 15 minutes later, I was out. I said, life is too short for American film.
By the way, we're so used to people being like, I will not watch any film with an Israeli director. To hear it to say something about Israel, I'm like, oh, that is so offensive.
You've taken the boycott to us.
But Israelis are like this.
He's BDSing Hollywood. That's amazing. Yeah, I love superhero movies, so I can't join
you
him.
You can't do that.
I feel like doing it, but I won't.
So, and we have an Israeli superhero now. So there.
Yes, we do. Yes.
Gail Gadot.
Well, it's like,
according
Gail
to Gadot. The Oscars.
Yeah, we should call Gail as well.
Gail.
Do people, I mean, the funny thing about Gal Gadot is Gal Beckerman, who's at the New York Times, tweeted, like, the best thing about Gal Gadot is that people no longer mispronounce my name, because actually people have to pronounce Gal, which to us seems so natural, but I guess everyone calls them Gal.
Gal.
Do people have trouble with Gil? Gil seems easy.
I always say I'm Gil like a fish Gil, and then they understand.
Ooh, very chefy.
But my last name is Hovav, and again, when I was living in California, nobody got it. They all thought it was Hovar, which apparently is a South American name, and I would always say Hovav, and say, yes, Mr. Hovar, yes, Mr. Hovar. So I'll change it.
Can we talk a little bit about food snobbery?
Sure.
You know,
what are we here for?
How do we fight the snobs, or do we join them?
We definitely fight them. We always remember that there was a dreadful, dreadful fad a few years ago that was called molecular cuisine, and now everybody is so embarrassed about it. So whenever, you know, you see food snobs, just think that they once were eating all these things with smoke and little rounds of whatever, and it's terrible. It's terrible. You know, I had a show about the best restaurants in the world.
Well,
and
a couple of them were, I mean, wasn't El Bulli molecular...
Exactly. So El Bulli was chosen the best restaurant in the world for 10 times in a row. And it's owned by two brothers, Ferran and Albert Adria. So since I was writing the script, I said, I'll bring my brother in too. So it's two brothers going to eat with your brother. The problem was that my brother is from Jerusalem, and Jerusalemites eat only hummus. So he asked me, will there be hummus on the menu? I said, well, not as we know it, at least. Anyway, we get to El Bulli, dreadful food. Really, something you don't want to eat twice. He puts, there's a soup there. We don't know what it's made of. My brother takes a spoonful of the soup into his mouth. Both Ferran and Albert look at us like this. The cameras are on, and my brother says, I'm not going to swallow this. So don't mess with Israelis.
Here's my predicament, right? So there are some things, and as you could see, a lot of them have to do with food that I'm very passionate about. So, for example, when it comes to coffee, I will go to very great lengths to get, you know, the perfect beans, roast them a certain way, myself, grind them a certain way, not drink Starbucks.
You're literally sitting there with a Starbucks
cups on the table.
But, right. Well, you know, a person has to be in the world. But, you know, I take great lengths and great pains and great expense at this. And yet, when I tell this to some of my friends, maybe some of my friends who are sitting in this room today, they say, yeah, you know, are you just...
You call that a friend?
Just a freaking food snob.
No, I don't think so.
Is there a defensive quality?
I see a lot of beauty in it, really. I think that we should be passionate about what we do, and it may be food, it may be clothing, it may be art, it may be relationship. It gives you a good feeling to know that you're doing something to the end.
Do you have
but then you wake
like
up
this?
In the morning and you drink Starbucks, so I don't trust you.
Do you have obsessions like this? Food obsessions, things that you would absolutely need perfect or nothing at all?
Well, first of all, there are tons of things that I don't put in my mouth. I don't drink water.
you and my kids both.
Fish fucking it. No, yeah. You don't put it in your mouth. I don't eat honey. I don't drink milk. I don't eat cooked spinach. And I don't eat anything that came out of the sea. No fish, no seafood, not for kosher reasons, of course. I just don't like the taste.
If you started a religion, I think I'll join. Wow.
So calling your book charming, I don't mean to belittle it. I just mean it is such these tales of you growing up and your family.
I'm good with charming.
It's just so lovely. And especially your Muma, who is your grandmother, and she just takes care of you, and she sort of makes the world around you, right? Like she brought the beach to you when you couldn't go to the beach because you were sick. But the funny thing is, your family's also like super famous, right?
It is.
I feel like I know about them, but not the way like Liel probably you know about them.
Or the way that I, having read a Wikipedia entry, know about them. No, you're
but
great,
I know them as like Muma.
Right. Your great grandfather helped revive modern Hebrew, right? Basically.
He almost did it single-handed.
Yeah, he didn't help revive Hebrew.
It was revived, but he invented
much
it, right?
By himself did it.
Right. Yes.
Eliezer Ben Yehuda.
Yeah.
So Ben Yehuda.
Did you have a sense growing up like, hey, these guys are machers?
So when I was growing up, it was funny because I really do not believe in aristocracy. And I really, during my 56 years, I have met so many idiots that are the sons of geniuses and vice versa.
Right.
So each of us has to prove whoever he or she is for themselves. But in my family, they really believed that they were aristocracy. And we tend to rank cities in Israel according to the size of the Ben Yehuda street that we got. And so Jerusalem is good, Tel Aviv is good, Be'er Sheva is good, Ra'anana is good, Haifa, you know. But they were always communists, so we never trusted them. And people, you know, in my family, they always expected Ben Yehuda to be on notes of money. They were always offended that they picked just presidents. I said, but the Ben Yehuda is more important. So
Charette got a bill.
Yeah, come on.
Grandpa didn't.
And so for me, I think that this is one of the reasons for writing this book and the two others in the trilogy. It's called the Jerusalem Trilogy. It's all memoirs about my family. And it's all about this. It's so funny, the gap between their thoughts of aristocracy and their dream about having Formica closets. So this, you know, this collision between the two, I found it very funny as a kid and as a grown up. And this is what I wrote about, but it's also about the longing for the old days when people really knew the rules, because I walk the streets with Muma, my grandmother, and she knows what's right and what's wrong. And she gave me the most important rule of life. She told me, you know, we always talk about Jewish grandmothers who feed their children. My grandma would block me from getting to the table, and she would always ask, did you make sure that the beggar on the street got food? Did you make sure that our maid got food? Did you feed the birds in the balcony? Only after you do these three, you're entitled to have your own meal. And this is the best rule ever.
Was that literally true? You had to go do those three things?
Yes, 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 yes. So every time, every time.
Real aristocracy is treating people well.
If there is real aristocracy, but yes.
And for Micah closets.
And for Micah closets.
My father, the advice I got from my father is if you don't know what to order, get the club sandwich. Which I think is a pretty good piece of advice.
We'll add that to our religion. Yeah. Yes.
But first you have to give some of the club sandwich to the beggar and the birds.
And the birds. So, yeah. And the bees. Gil Hovav, thank you so much for being our Jew of the Week.
Thank you very much, guys. It's the first time I'm a Jew of anything, so there's always a first.
The bar is low in America.
Here you really, you're passing flying
colors.
And
this is actually the Ben Yehuda studio. So you should feel very comfortable and respected and honored.
Thank you very, very much.
And people who want to experience more of you should buy your book. Candies from Heaven.
Yep. And they have to.
It's mandatory.
They should definitely do that. Otherwise, Gal Gadot will come at them. But totally dressed.
And by the way, Gal and Gil is a great
Gal
show waiting to happen.
That's the real Jerusalem trilogy. We just need one more person. Yeah.
And I'm going to find your quality cooking shows for my children to practice their Hebrew with.
Please do.
All right. Thanks, Gil. Wondering when it's gonna come or where it's been. May have got your heart broken a few times in the past. We are elated to be joined in the studio this morning by our producer, Josh Cross. We have two matters of business to discuss. First of all, there was a simcha in the Cross family this past weekend, right?
Indeed.
And this was your son Miles' bar mitzvah?
Yep.
How'd it go?
It was great for a completely secular atheist shindig that my rabbi that I've known for my entire life came and still did his blessing and everything. It was wonderful.
Awesome. Who's your rabbi?
Eric Wisnia.
Eric Wisnia. So
it's Beth Chaim in West Windsor.
Rabbinic supervision for the Cross family this week by Eric Rabb.
My entire life, rabbinic supervision.
It's awesome.
We brought him to France to get married with him. Like, he's done everything.
That was a sweet gig for him.
Yeah, it was.
All right. So slightly less important. You have set up this extraordinary swag shop for us. You want to tell us about it?
Well, let's give props to Esther as well, whose name is always in the credits. But she also, we've put up another new shirt with a bagel on it, and it's wonderful. It's everything, actually, if you will. And we are going to be rolling out mugs.
That was a bagel joke. I just got that. Took me a second.
Have you seen that? Yeah. We'll be bringing out mugs shortly, and I'm sourcing some other products that people have been clamoring
the mug is
for.
On. I have purchased a mug.
Yeah, did they put the mug on for like in the last day or so?
Yeah,
I didn't see that got added, but
the mug
I didn't look today,
which is an important response to an outcry on the Facebook page. Several people have been like, "Where's the mug?"
No, I've been working on it.
Yeah,
you just can go to bit.ly/unorthoshirt, and that'll take you right to our store.
Awesome. All right, thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
And Mazel Tov, Miles Cross.
So Passover is upon us.
It is
pretty soon.
Pretty soon.
When you guys sit at the table, what Haggadah do you read?
Well, you know, we have always used the Richard Kodor Joyous Haggadah, which has wonderful illustrations. And from time to time, we've used the Maxwell House Haggadah just for sort of kitsch retro purposes. But I can't say that I've ever found the Haggadah that feels like, oh, this, like we've arrived in the promised land of Haggadot.
There's no one Haggadah that really captures the essence of who we are as curious, dare I say, unorthodox Jews?
There is no such Haggadah.
Mark, what are we going to do about it?
I think that we have to create a Haggadah. I think that we have been called, that for such a time as this, just as Esther was sent to the palace in Shushan, for such a time as that, we have been called to make a Haggadah for such a time as this. Do you think so?
I think the time is right.
The time is right. We are making a Haggadah. We've decided right here and now that we are going to create our own Haggadah. It will be reasonably halachically complete. In other words, if you want the full service, it will be there. But it will be...
It may omit a thing or two.
It will omit a thing or two.
But not too much.
In the interest of keeping it family friendly and somewhat brief, we will edit it down. We will get contributions.
We know you want to get to the food.
Yep.
We'll keep all the halacha you need and none that you don't.
None that you don't. We will include some...
Contributions.
Some contributions from famous Jews who have been on our show and a few who haven't. And we're working on that right now.
Some additions to the traditions.
Yep. Will we create some new traditions?
We absolutely will.
A kumquat on the Seder plate, perhaps?
It will be a very unorthodox Passover. So if you enjoy this here show, and if you enjoy Passover,
because who doesn't like food?
If you're a fan of eating and telling stories, there is a very special unorthodox Haggadah, downloadable as a PDF, beautifully designed, for free.
And what day will it be available?
It will be available. It will be available. Fuck, what did we decide here?
We have no fucking idea when it'll be available.
It will be available on Tuesday, March 27th. That is 3 days.
That's cutting it a bit close.
Before the Seder. Well, but we're unorthodox.
We are
Jews.
Unorthodox.
And so we know that you're not exactly fretting about, you know, you're not plotting.
Right.
And so we will send you, by means to be announced soon, a beautiful, downloadable, printable, shareable,
illustrated,
traditional,
funny,
gorgeous,
Hamish,
sexy
Haggadah. Downloadable March 27th.
Our second Jew of the week, we cannot get enough of these Jews this week, is Allen Robert Ginsberg. He is an historian and a visiting scholar at the Center for American Studies at Columbia University. He, too, has a book that we're going to be talking about. It's called The Salome Ensemble. I was so worried about saying Salome wrong that I said ensemble wrong.
That was amazing.
So the Salome Ensemble.
Yes.
Allen Robert Ginsberg, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Do you
thank
have
you.
To have the Robert in there?
No. It's,
can you just
it's,
be Allen Ginsberg
it's,
for us?
I'm happy to be Allen Ginsberg, but there's so many other Allen Ginsbergs in the world. I don't usually use my middle
name. I mean,
there's
one in particular.
There's one in particular, and he died like 18 years ago or so. And I still get people immediately when I introduce myself saying, are you the Allen Ginsberg?
So yes,
I say yes, I'm the Allen Ginsberg.
I will levitate the Pentagon.
That you're speaking to.
Then I will recite Howl and Kaddish.
Exactly. And, yeah. I do Howl. I do recite Kaddish, but I'm not that guy.
So your book includes, among others, one of my favorite historical figures, Rose Pastor Stokes.
Is that right? She's one of your favorites?
Absolutely. I had a friend in college who wrote a senior essay about her and was always talking about her. And it was fabulous. But tell us about the women at the center of your book and, you know, how they found each other.
Well, Rose Pastor Stokes is the at the center of the book, and she is kind of the leader of what I call the Salome Ensemble.
It's actually ensemble.
Ensemble.
Ensemble. But I think it's ensemble. Rose Pastor Stokes was a very prominent and wealthy and famous Jewish woman for a while in the early 20th century. She is largely forgotten today, except to academics and you and your
yep.
buddy. Yes.
I'm into her, yeah.
She's hopefully become, I hope she's coming back into style now.
Yeah.
She was born in the Russian Pale in 1878. She was the daughter of an arranged marriage that was literally a forced marriage. Her mother was dragged to the chuppah by her parents because she had fallen in love with a Gentile Polish man, and that was forbidden love. So her parents arranged a marriage with a Jewish man, and she had a daughter with this man who became Rose Pastor Stokes. The father abandoned them by the time Rose was three, and Rose and her mom moved to London, and then Hindle married a guy named Pastor, Israel Pastor, a Jewish man. And then they moved to Cleveland, where Rose grew up in really terrible poverty. I mean, literally starvation poverty. Rose left school, became a roller of cigars in sweatshops in Cleveland, and educated herself by reading the books and magazines and newspapers that were passed around in the sweatshop, and became an avid writer of letters to the editor of newspapers. And
that's how I got my start, by the way.
Is that right?
It is, actually. Yeah, writing to the Springfield Daily News. Yeah.
Well, you guys are all the spiritual descendants of
Rose
Salome,
Pastor Stokes.
Of Rose Pastor Stokes, all these Salome Ensemble people. I mean, it's really true. I mean, I usually look to women in the media. So Stephanie, Alana Newhouse, Barry Weiss, Shira Telushkin, Dara Horn, all the people who I think of who are Jewish women in the media today, and that's a very short list. There's a much longer list than that, obviously, are the spiritual heirs of these women. Rose started writing letters to the editors of a newspaper called the Yiddish Tageblach, Jewish Daily News in New York, from Cleveland. They loved her letters. They asked her to write a column. She started writing a column. They moved her to New York, where she became a reporter. She was rescued from the sweatshops. She was able to make just enough money now to actually live, as opposed to eking out, you know, starvation wages in the sweatshop. And she moved her mother and half siblings to New York even her stepfather, like her original father, abandoned the family. So this was were defining moments for her. He, you know, born into a marriage that was bad and arranged, forced from the beginning, abandoned by her father, abandoned ultimately by her stepfather. And I think of these things as sort of the big bang of these women.
But then she finally found a good Gentile man, right?
She was hired by the newspaper to interview famous people. And Lillian Wald was among her people, a lot of other people that she interviewed. And then she interviewed and fell in love with and married what today we would call a billionaire, okay? Well, he had $1,000 100 right. years ago, but it was billions of dollars today. He was a captain of industry. He was the scion of a family that traced its roots back to colonial America. And his name was James Graham Phelps Stokes. And
when you've got four names.
Right. You got four names, you know, and that was not all he had. And he owned railroads and mining interests and all kinds of other businesses. But he was almost a socialist. He was a very wealthy philanthropist. And he, to his credit, not only talked the talk and didn't only give lots of money, which he did, to various reform causes and poor people and charities. He actually moved to the Lower East Side and lived among the poorest people in the city. Yeah, he had a nice apartment, but it was like right in the, you know, in the middle of the Lower East Side.
It was like a walk up.
Yeah,
it was a walk up.
He bought three tenements and combined them together.
He lived in a decent place, but he worked at the university settlement.
Had buckets of hot water brought up.
He did. Yeah. He did. He didn't deprive himself, but he did go further than many other people would have gone at the time. And Rose felt that he was handsome and this amazing fellow. And she married him and became a very wealthy woman, from going from literally not having enough to eat to being one of the wealthiest women in the country. And she was forever conflicted about that. She had guilt, and she wanted to take care of the people that she had left behind. She had a real sense of solidarity with poor people, with workers, with women, with Jews. Although she was not, she eventually moved away from the women's causes and the Jewish causes and became increasingly what she called an internationalist, a socialist. She believed that capitalism had to be tempered with socialism, and as long as there was democracy, as there was in the United States, you wouldn't need a violent revolution. But she was applauding the violent revolutions elsewhere.
So explain to us the Salome Ensemble.
So Rose came to New York the way I explain, and then these other women also came to New York from Europe and eventually connected with Rose. So Anzia Yezierska, who was a year younger than Rose, came with a very large family. She and her parents and nine siblings moved to the Lower East Side, and Anzia was very unhappy with the squalid conditions. And
she ended up writing The Bread Givers.
She ended up writing The Bread Givers, right. And she ended up writing a book called Salome of the Tenements.
Right.
And Salome of the Tenements was a book written about her friend Rose. Rose Pastor Stokes was the role model for Salome of the Tenements. She was also the role model for all these women to emulate. Okay, that's how they became the Salome Ensemble. So Yezierska wrote the Salome of the Tenements. It was loosely based on the life of Rose, about a poor woman who is a journalist and marries a wealthy Gentile, a Jewish woman who marries a wealthy Gentile. But the rest of the book and the rest of the characters are really filled in from Anzia's own life and from the life of Sonia Levine, who's the third woman in this series. Sonia was a little younger, several years younger than the other two women. And she also met with Rose Pastor Stokes on the Lower East Side. Rose introduced Sonia and Anzia to each other. Sonia basically almost moved into Rose and James Graham Stokes's, Phelps Stokes's apartment.
Well, they had room.
They had plenty of room, and they had a vast library, which Sonia was in love with. Sonia became their secretary, and she was able to read all the books that she had always been deprived of and wanted to read. And she eventually went to law school. She became one of the very early women lawyers, not to mention early women Jewish lawyers, to graduate at NYU and in New York State. And then she became a magazine editor and a screenwriter, and she turned Salome of the Tenements novel into a screenplay. The fourth woman was Jetta Goudal, who was an actress. She was the only one of the four who came from Amsterdam, Netherlands, not Russia or the Russian Pale. And she was the daughter of diamond merchants and came to the United States, changed her name, denied that she was Jewish, denied that she was Dutch, which is something that endlessly, I'm not sure why the Dutch thing bothered her, but she claimed to be French. I've heard her voice on audio. She has a Germanic or Yiddish sounding accent. It reminds me of my grandmother.
The funny thing about this book is I was just thinking, it's crazy that this is like the 1920s and these women are just doing really amazing stuff. And they're so vibrant. They're so filled with agency. And yes, they have, you know, a wealthy husband who can help. Like there are certainly those elements, but there was something that felt so current about this story. And at the same time, like, you know, young women new to New York City, which, you know, still is a thing that happens, even though we're not coming from the old country, and really, really helping each other out and advocating for each other. And I found it so fascinating because I feel like that is sort of what's happening today, right? We see a lot of younger people trying to help each other build these networks that are non-traditional almost.
And they took it sort of for granted. I mean, it's not that they were such wonderful friends. Rose and Anzia were great friends for a while. Anzia and Sonia were sort of acquaintances. Sonia loved Rose. Jetta only knew of the group, really only spent a lot of time with Sonia. So it wasn't like you wouldn't see them walking
like
down the street, you know, holding arms. It's not Sex in the City 1925, okay?
Nor but even Laverne and Shirley.
Salome in the City.
But at the same time, one of the themes of the book and of your work is that we have these misconceptions of immigrant women and their limitations and who they were. I mean, how do we misunderstand, how do stereotypes of Jewish immigrant women not match the reality?
These women surmounted the obstacles. What happened was I started to study this because of my grandmother. I had my grandparents and great-grandparents when I was a little kid, and one grandmother, my mom's mom, was 50 when I was born, and she lived until I was 50. She lived to be 100. She was lucid to the very last, and she was a wonderful woman, and I spent a lot of time talking with her. She was my first consultant on this book, and she arrived in the United States in 1922, and in 1925, the movie version from Paramount Pictures, Salome of the Tenements, was released, and she saw that film. So she was telling me about it.
It's crazy.
This is how some of the immigrant women, including my grandparents and great-grandparents, the young women, she was 15 at the time she arrived, so I guess she was 18 when she saw this movie. They taught themselves English by reading and translating the intertitle cards on the silent films. It was part of their first English lessons to each other.
And was it a big deal that these were Jewish character? I mean, that this was a Jewish woman in a big silent film?
It was a big thing at the time. It was filmed in Astoria Studios on what was then the largest movie set that had ever been built. And they reconstructed several blocks of the Lower East Side, and they recruited hundreds of Jewish immigrants from the Lower East Side. They were shouting instructions through megaphones in Yiddish and English for the people to know where to go and what to do. And people got there from the Lower East Side to Astoria Studios, and they were thrilled because they could the set was so accurate that they could point out their own apartments. It was like, that's where I live.
That's my pickle shop.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the pickle shop I don't go to.
Right.
I guarantee you some listener of ours of this show has a great-grandparent who was an extra.
No, I love that. Idea that it's sort of like a census some way. So what happens to the movie? Silent films, are they around?
There are many, many movies that are still around from that era, and an earlier movie from 3 years earlier based on another Anzia Yezierska book called Hungry Hearts does exist, and you can see it.
I've seen Hungry Hearts.
There you go.
But the Salome.
This one is unfound. I've been looking for it for almost 15 years, and I've crossed the country looking for it. I've spoken
for a print of Salome of the Tenements.
Yes, it's gone apparently. But I still hold out hope that somebody has it in their basement or attic or something. But Paramount Pictures has scoured its archives. But I've also gone to the Library of Congress, which has almost 400 really pristine still photographs or rush pictures from screen grabs, we would say today, from the film. And so you can, and they're on cloth backing, you know, there's old kinds of photographs that are preserved. So you can almost flip book the film.
Right.
Wow.
But I'm making the film now. We're going to do a remake. We're going to make, not a remake of Selma. Gal Gadot in the Selma Ensemble. We're making a documentary out of it now. I need Jewish women who want to play these women.
All right. So if they want to get in touch with you, how do they do it?
agins1956@gmail.com.
Gins with an S.
A-G-I-N-S. 1956@gmail.com.
We need more guests giving their emails. Yes. On the air. Totally. But I will be, whatever you need, I'm in.
And Liel and I will
be. All right, you're in.
We need you in there.
You're a rose.
Liel and I will be extras. Liel will be the pickle merchant.
You'll be the milkman.
No, I will
the
be.
The seltzer guy.
I will be the tefillin repair man.
Yes, but these women also, you know, this is a very Jewish story, but these women interacted with, they had affairs with, they sued Woodrow Wilson, John Dewey, Cecil B. DeMille famously was sued by Jetta Goodall. Sonia Levine had an affair with Sinclair Lewis.
This book is so ridiculous.
There's a lot of saucy stuff in there.
The book is The Salome Ensemble, Rose Pastor Stokes, Andrea Yezierska, Sonia Levine, and Jetta Goodall. The author is our favorite Allen Ginsberg, yes. Allen Robert Ginsberg. Thank you.
The real Allen Ginsberg.
And I'm so honored to be one of the Jews of the Week.
You are a JOTW.
You're a big Jew.
Thanks, Allen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ensemble on va au cinéma et on dîne au restaurant. Ensemble on se promène au bois avec le chien et les enfants.
We have three live experiences to invite you to. First of all, March 8th, so that's like today. If you're listening Thursday and you have time to get to Vermont tonight, if I haven't been snowed out, I will be at the Roy Event Room of the Dion Family Center on the campus of St. Michael's College near Burlington, Vermont at 4:30 p.m. Montreal listeners, hop in your car, get some bagels, and drive on down across the border to come see me. If you don't make it, I hope we're going to post some audio of it or video. I'm going to be talking about Judaism in 2118. We're going to look 100 years into the future and talk about what's going to be up with our people. March 21st, the whole crew will be at JCC Manhattan with Bart Campolo, who's an extraordinary figure I wrote about for the New York Times Magazine. He's a former superstar evangelical preacher who had a bad bicycle accident, was in a coma, and came out and had lost his faith. And he then became a secular humanist chaplain. The guy's amazing. And the Jew of the Week will be Senator Joseph Mordechai Pinchas
Schmoichel Herschel
Zvi Dovber Lieberman. Senator Joe Lieberman will be our Jew of the Week, March 21st, JCC Manhattan. Buy your tickets now. And then, if you just want a little bissel of me, this isn't really me, but I'll be there. June 11th through 13th, you can come study storytelling at Yale University. It's a program that I run there called Thread. Among the faculty will be Catherine Burns, former Gentile of the Week Catherine Burns, who is the artistic director of The Moth, This American Life producer Stephanie Fu, Snap Judgment's host Glenn Washington, Jill Abramson, former editor of The New York Times, just confirmed that she will be there as well. It's an amazing faculty.
Do you know how Jill Abramson has a tattoo of the Times logo on her shoulder?
Yeah, which she got before she was fired.
Should we get unorthodox tattoos?
That would be super unorthodox.
Could we get halachic permission to do that?
Cross is like, yes, big thumbs up. Josh wants it. Your rabbi, will David Ingber give us halachic permission?
We could talk about that.
So anyway, if you want to see me and Jill Abramson and Catherine Burns and Glenn Washington, June 11th through 13th, we'll be at Yale teaching storytelling. It's we take applications from anyone. You don't have to be a professional of any sort. It's a really, really wonderful and diverse group. June 11th through 13th, go to thread.yale.edu. To the mailbox. First, a call-in.
Hi, this is Lincoln Mitchell. I was struck in your discussion of greatest Jewish television characters because there is an answer, an empirical answer to this question. The greatest Jewish television character ever is Spock, and I was struck that none of you noticed that or knew that. And maybe I'm just older than you and know that, but he was an extremely important both actor and also the character who created on Star Trek, which is a technically Vulcan, but in many respects was Jewish. Thanks. Bye.
Liel?
Respect to that.
Respect? Do you feel like Spock was actually coded Jewish?
So here's the thing. I mean, you look at Leonard Nimoy's Punim, right? And you're like, right. Of course.
And Nimoy was a great Jew in many ways.
Right. And so many, you know, so much of the wisdom and the Kohanim blessing with the fingers and everything. But at the same time, that emphasis on kind of like the intense rationality, to me as a kind of a neo-Hasidic Jew, kind of reads like, okay, well,
yeah, he was just a droid.
He was from the Misnagdim, not the Hasidim.
He was Litvish.
I have not understood a single word of this conversation.
Well, try this
letter. There are three people out there who listen who are laughing very hard right now.
The important takeaway for people not in the know, and I've seen like four episodes of Star Trek ever, is that the thing that the Vulcan hand thing is actually the Jewish priestly hand thing.
When
you give the priestly blessing in synagogue.
Yes.
Ergo, everything. Second letter. Dear J. Crew, after this week's show, I felt compelled to write with two questions. Number one, what the Fabringen is a grogger? I've never heard this pronunciation before. Isn't it pronounced Gregor? At least in Canada, home of Drake, Geddy Lee, and Leonard Cohen, to name just a few great Jewish noisemakers. I'll stop there. Gregor? I've never even heard Gregor. Grogger?
I've only heard of Gregor Mendel.
Well, it's a Scottish pronunciation. That's why we have Ewan McGregor.
McGregor.
He was born in Arab Purim.
All right. Number two. This is.
No, I never heard Gregor. I only know from Grogger.
Canada. So this letter writer, Andrea Safer, says the Canadian pronunciation is Gregor.
So here's what we need to do.
This is a huge question.
What is that a boot?
It's a mishmash situation, but we need Drake to go like on the record or on a record and say the word Grogger.
On any record.
Yeah. Number two, Andrea writes, you mean there are people who don't use top sheets? Do they wash their duvet covers every week? And if they don't, do they enjoy sleeping under dirty linens? Actually, a third question. When are you going to do a live show in Toronto? I'll be there when you do. Thanks from the six, Andrea Safer. Well, Andrea, we did a live show in Toronto.
Some of us did.
Liel didn't make it for various passport reasons. We would love to come back. Talk to your local people with money.
Talk to your local elected board members.
Talk to your local Jews.
No. We had an amazing show.
So fun.
At Beth Zedek. It's too bad Liel didn't make it because he forgot his passport.
I want to go back. I would love to go back to Toronto.
So in three parts. Number one, we've never heard of a Gregor. Must be a Canadian thing. Number two, I'm totally with you there on top sheets.
And number three, give us money.
We'd love to come to Toronto. Okay. Third letter. Salutations from Seoul. In Korean culture, top sheets aren't used. In other news from Seoul, did you ever see my email with the Cafe Briss photo? L'chaim, Deborah Abrams. Yes, Deborah. On the Facebook page, you posted a photograph of a Seoul cafe called Cafe Briss.
And when Molly Yeh was at the Olympics in Pyeongchang, she kept sending pictures of the Cafe Briss. And it's really... I don't understand it, but someone I'm sure will tell us what
I know
what
where
means.
We're having the Oppenheimer Simcha.
At the Cafe Briss.
Cafe Briss in Seoul. Let's fly the whole clan.
No, there'll be one in Chelsea Market
Korea.
By then.
That's right.
We'll crowdfund. We'll Kickstarter a trip to Cafe Briss.
Absolutely.
For the Briss. Fourth letter. Shalom. Ani Daniel. I am Daniel. I'm just a Gentile nobody from Melbourne, Australia. Love the show. 2 weeks in a row mentioning Jewish characters in the OC. First Seth, then Sandy Cohen. Can we make it 3 weeks running? What about Nana Cohen? Or Sandy's fugitive ex-love, Rachel? Yours, Daniel Zunert.
Snaps for Nana.
Nana.
Love
Snaps
her.
For Nana. Daniel, you're not a Gentile nobody. You're a Gentile somebody.
Also, what about Rachel's dad, the professor?
So I didn't watch the show that much.
What? Okay, that actually makes sense.
I liked it, but I was like... 30 at the time.
No, I'm saying, missed you.
Yeah, right. It missed me.
It was just my formative years.
Yeah. When I was
college.
When I was a long-term sub in 2004 at Newton North High School in Newton, Massachusetts, the kids were watching the OC. And so I'd kind of like drop in on an episode now and again so I could be
You'd
down.
You'd be like, hey, Seth and Summer, have they gotten together yet?
Exactly. And finally, our final.
I like the voice. That's exactly the voice.
That's a teacher.
Hey, kids. Hey, kid. That was my cool substitute. Hey, kids. All right. Number four.
Laverne and Shirley, did they have boyfriends yet?
What about Joni and Chachi?
Do they smoke reefer?
The Golden Girls.
All right, finally, a little somewhat on a more somber note. Dear friends, this is a letter from our longtime fan, Judith Clough. Dear friends, I'll tell you something you already know. What's really, really not Jewish is cremation. You knew that, right? But what you perhaps did not know, aside from a million agadic rulings, is why. Because it's horrible. That's why. A month ago, my beloved partner of 50 years, more or less, off and on, died. He was regrettably, my regret, not his, not Jewish, but was instead a seeker, which is why he was a member in excellent standing of two churches, one Episcopal for the music and one Anthroposophist for the neighborhood, as well as the Boston Center for Nichiren Buddhism. So if he wanted to be cremated, let his mother worry, right? I hadn't given it much thought, being preoccupied as I was with missing him overwhelmingly while trying to deal with his account at Florida Power and Light. My brother-in-law, the brother of my late ex-husband, if you must know, went with me to pick up the cremains, and I was suddenly faced with the fact that this enormous presence, this light of my being, this object of my passionate love, was in a smallish cardboard box on the table. I can't stand it. Please, no matter how concerned you are with the environment or giving space to affordable housing, bury your dead in the ground. If he were properly moldering and returning to dust, I could imagine that his spirit has surely become one with the whirling molecules of the universe, as we are promised in the Shema. This way, he's in the cabinet where he kept the sheet music, and I can't even remember who he was because of the fucking box. I do not let myself think of the process that got him there. That's too much even for me. So next time someone you love dies, get the shomrim, get the plain pine coffin without nails, get the kittel, and put your beloved safely and sanely in the ground. The sages knew what I now know. Honest. Love to you all, your old friend, Judith Clough.
Wow.
Judith, may you know no more sorrow. And thank
you
for
sending you love, Judith.
Very beautiful letter.
I just want to say, I met Judith when I was in high school. This is a story she and I have because she came to our live show in Boston. She was part of the visiting accreditation committee. She was a teacher at the Groton School, and she was chosen to be part of the committee that reaccredited the Loomis Chafee School, where I was then a student. This is like deep prep school knowledge. Anyway, we were seated next to each other at a table in the dining hall, and it turned out we'd grown up one street away from each other in Springfield, Massachusetts, as Jews in this very Gentile town. And I always remembered her. And when she became a listener to our show, I remembered the name Judith Clough, and I said, we met in 1990, and we talked about Texel Drive and Bronson Terrace.
Did she remember?
I don't know if she remembered, but I love this woman, and she has been such a fan of the show, and she has so much soul, and we are overwhelmed with sorrow for your loss.
God bless.
If you want to send us a letter, write to unorthodox@tabletmag.com or leave us a voicemail at 914-570-4869. We read everything and we listen to everything. All right.
Mazel tov.
Liel, what do you have?
I would like to extend a hearty mazel tov to Stephanie.
What?
Taylor Butnick.
Swift. Taylor Swift Butnick.
Taylor Swift Butnick. It's legal.
Who worked so freaking hard on this amazing, amazing, amazing 100 Jewish Foods project, and help create really one of the most magnificent, fun, you know, appetizing things that I've seen in a very long while.
Thank you. That's so nice.
It is beautiful. It is
Thank
amazing.
You.
And yeah. A fruit of so much hard work. 100jewishfoods.tabletmag.com.
I'm going to throw my mom a shout out. It's Elisa's birthday today. It'll be Mazel 2 days late by the time she hears this. But I love her so much. And she's in Nepal. Like, they're on this Whoa. Crazy trip. She's going to be on a helicopter around Everest today for her birthday, which I think is like a pretty good way to spend it. So 2 days later, she'll get to hear this.
Sweet. Elise,
come home soon,
from
Mom.
Us too.
I got a couple. First of all, a shout out to the Yeshiva University Maccabees. They lost in the first round of the Division III tournament for basketball to York College of Pennsylvania. But they made it there, and we're proud of you guys. And I think it's a Cinderella story, but I'm hungering for a Jewish pun.
It was March Michigas.
March Michigas.
And now it's over.
And then I also want to give a big shout out to a mazel tov to our Facebook group, to the Unorthodox Facebook group, because
yes.
I had a friend who needed a Seder in Vancouver, Canada. This is someone who came to our Seder last year. She was going to be in Vancouver, and I was like, hey, let's crowdsource this mother. And they found her a Seder in Vancouver.
Unbelievable.
Three minutes later, we have a big Hamish Seder for her.
If you're not in our Facebook group,
there's also a very serious Minnesota recommendation thread going on for someone who's moving there. So
yep.
Just get involved in that.
We will find you Jewish love anywhere in the world.
And then finally, I think a very, very, very hearty mazel tov to the Oppenheimers.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
On the edition of Boy Named TBD for Highest Bidder, Oppenheimer.
Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or call us at 914-570-4869. Remember, we want your questions for the Passover Advice episode, so drop us a line. For merchandise, you want to go to bit.ly/unorthoshirt. That's bit.ly/unorthoshirt. Follow Stephanie on Instagram at sbutnick. Join our Facebook group. Our show is produced by Joshua Cross and Shira Tolushkin with help from Julia Frakes. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our show is edited by Noah Levinson. Our music is by Golem online at golemrocks.com. Our mailbox theme is by Steve Barton. Check out his new triple CD. Rabbinic Supervision this week by Rabbi Michael Schwartz up in Andover, Massachusetts. It was great to hear from you, Rabbi. If you think your rabbi should be selected to offer Rabbinic Supervision, write to me at moppenheimer@tabletmag.com. We record at Argo Studios, where we are engineered by the robust Paul Ruest, who oversees a Farrakhan free zone here on the 12th floor. We're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.